And you're very welcome to the RT Rugby Podcast ahead of Leinster and Munster this weekend. Very much looking forward to it, I guess, particularly so in the absence of any matches last weekend. Delighted to say Donal Lennon, Bernard Jackman and Wes Liddy are with me once again this week. You're welcome, gentlemen. And Birch, a lot of excitement about this game. I guess the proximity of the Six Nations, the hope that we might see two very strong teams. I'm really looking forward to it. I presume you are too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a while since we've had two full-strength teams go at it, and both teams in form. I know they played in the semi-final of the Pro 14, but they hadn't really many games leading into it, and I think Munster in a much better place going into this game. That the way win in Claremont would give them huge confidence. They're running away with their conference, and they've found that young new talent that's giving them a little bit more optimism and a little bit more depth. So, yeah, it's set to be a cracker, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Donal, when I was playing in the under-8s in Dr. Hickey Park for Greystones, one of the highlights of my season, I remember, was being asked to go in with a bunch of lads from my team to be ball boy for the probables against the possibles and getting autographs of all the players afterwards and then going on to see them play for Ireland in the forthcoming, whatever, Five Nations as it was then. But this is very much like that. For Andy Farrell's perspective, he's going to see two sides here who are going to be busting a gut to make an impression ahead of the Six Nations.
Absolutely. I think, there's two aspects to it. Obviously, a lot of the players have been starved of rugby over the past couple of weeks. Six Nations is around the corner. But this game stands alone on its own merits. Incredibly, when you look at the interest in the game, given that the two teams have met twice already. Well, you could say last season, but you're talking about, say, in August and September. You had that Pro 14 game in August, I think 22nd, that started the whole revamp of the season. The semi-final of the Pro 14 when Leinster really were, just too good for Munster on the day. But I think that game proved to be a turning point for Munster. I think they've, from that point forward, a lot of the international players went away into camp. We spoke about how, as a group with the younger players who started the new season and the Pro 14 campaign came together. And ever since then, they've been playing, they've tweaked the way they've played. You can see the subtle differences in the way that they're attacking. But to the collective will, if you like, I mean, that second half performance against Claremont was outstanding. So this game really is a measure as to how far Munster have come. It's a vital game for both in that, given the way the conferences are set out, Munster could in effect get rid of Leinster if they beat them. And Leinster, on the other hand, they have to win to stay in their conference because, even though they beat Ulster are still very much in line to top that pool. So, it's rare that you get these games when there's so much at stake. Then I suppose the other context is the Six Nations. We've spoken in other podcasts about, there really is only about three or four players who you could say are absolutely guaranteed their starting position on the Irish side. So from that perspective, a lot of the individuals will be really out to showcase their form against maybe somebody in the opposite jersey who's their direct competition for an Irish place.
And that's why I kind of mentioned, because I was thinking about this week about the context, of what used to be the probables against the possibles, and that came into my head, because you're going to have guys who think they're maybe the de facto, the first choice in their position, going up against guys who are trying to dislodge them, all in front of the Irish coaching staff, Paul O'Connell element as well coming into it. Like, it should make for a fire and brimstone this weekend.
Yeah, I think it will. But I can tell you it'll be totally different to the old final trial, the probables and the possibles. They were the worst games of all time. Especially when you were on the probables, because the only way was down. But anyway, thank God they're a thing of the distant past. The only other caveat, I think, I'm lucky enough, I'm going to be one of the people who are there. We're covering the match on RT Radio. But I got a text from Michael Corcoran last night in his usual positive sense to tell me that it's going to be -4 degrees, there's going to be snow, the pitch is going to be frozen, so bring your wooliest hat, your scarf and your gloves. I said, Mike, we don't wear gloves here in Munster. But anyway, hopefully the conditions won't spoil the match.
They certainly don't wear them in Young Munster, I can tell you that much as well. Wes, just all the elements going into this match will be great. I'm really looking forward to it. I'll be in the comfort of the fire and a couple of beers watching, so I'm looking forward to it. But the problems against the possibles analogy, do you see where I'm coming from there?
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose the Paul O'Connell thing is a fair point as well, that maybe people will think there's a kind of new perspective, certainly in terms of selection within the forward pack. So, yeah, it's brilliant that way. And it was great to see a little bit of needle even from the coach as well, from Johan van Gran yesterday, when kind of quizzed on the tactics that Munster employed in the last meeting between the two sides. So it's good to see that things haven't become so homogenised that there's still room for a bit of spite between the provinces as well.
There has to be.
Yeah, and it's like, in fairness, I suppose the question about Munster's, after those two losses, the style of play of Munster as much as the personnel was being questioned for kind of the umpteen time in the last few years. And, like, they often did play, you know, quite an attacking approach in regular Pro 14 games. It was in these big games, particularly in semi-finals of both competitions, that they kind of reverted to this much narrower, much more rudimentary kind of game plan. And I suppose now, I mean, Claremont aside, this will be, they do look to have expanded in the intervening months, but I suppose this will be the test of, do they revert to type now against Leinster? Because if you think back to all the criticism they got after that semi-final defeat, Johan was still quite bullish in terms of defending the actual tactics they employed that day. It was more the execution he had a problem with. And I think Bernard was actually in agreement with him that there wasn't a lot wrong with the tactics. They might have been pretty on the eye, but they did actually create opportunities to win. They just didn't execute properly on the day. So it will be interesting to see what kind of how they go about taking Leinster on. And like, I'd still have reservations around, do they have it at number 10 to win a game against Leinster, a big game against Leinster, or is there too much room for inconsistency there still?
Okay, we'll come back to the 10 issue in just a second. But Bernard, put your coach's hat on for a minute then. And if you're Van Gran, how do you think he's going to set up to try and to best effect get the better of this Leinster team? Is there something in what Connacht did to Leinster the last time at the RDS that he can employ, or are they just two different squads with two different sets of players?
Yeah, look, and I think Connacht, the Connacht situation is different. I think they caught Leinster a little bit on the hop, and it wouldn't be the same strength team that Leinster sent to Munster. I think Johan is a creature of habit, so he's only won one of eight games against Leinster. I think he obviously feels that aerial bombardment is the way forward, or it certainly did, you know, back in the autumn. They kicked the ball, I think, 26 times that day, and only got back five back. So their work in the air wasn't good enough. Their accuracy wasn't good enough. It didn't really bother Leinster. But the key, I know you said we're not going to talk about tens, but the key difference between the teams on the day was, unfortunately, JJ, who that week had been awarded Golden Boot, he had a 33% success rate, which, you know, if you're going to beat Leinster, you got to kick your goals. And in fairness to Munster, since that game, they've been very good at taking points when they were on offer. And I think it's a big challenge for JJ if he starts is to be accurate with the boot.
Do you think he will start, Bernard? Sorry.
Yeah, I think he will start, to be honest. I think he will. I'd love to see him have a big game. I think, you know, he deserves one for his resilience, and he has lots of ability. But for some reason, historically, when the pressure's been on, he hasn't really followed through on it. So I think this is a big opportunity for him to prove he's the man in the 10 jersey for Munster, particularly with goal kicking. Because I think to beat Leinster, you got to have a high percentage from your kicker. It's going to be absolutely massive. I think they have more strings to their bow now, so I think they won't be as one-dimensional as they were. But if you look at how Munster have play, even now with all this focus on the new attacking freedom, etc., they don't play in their own half, and they're very belligerent around that. So you're going to have to win some balls back, or you're going to have to find space in the backfield from your kicking game. So I would expect it to be okay, a little bit more elaborate or more adventurous, but not too much more. And as Wesley said, it's the execution that's going to decide. And also, I think if you look at Leinster, you won't beat Leinster by all-out attack. They're better than everyone else in the attacking game. So you have to make sure that you're defensively very, very strong. And I think Munster will get a lot of confidence from how they shut down Connacht, who have a very good attack. And Barrow's last you know, 6 or 7 minutes, I thought it was probably one of the most dominant defensive displays I've seen from any Irish province over the course of the season. I think that's what they will learn from that Connacht win again. Okay, Connacht, you know, they took gambles. They got two intercept tries. But I thought it was the way Connacht upset Leinster at the breakdown. You know, how they defended with huge line speed intensity. That's probably the game plan that Johan will be looking, the element of the game plan that Johan will be looking at this week and saying, you know, if we implement that, that'll be the key to winning.
The battle up front, Donald, is going to be fascinating. I'm sure Paul O'Connell will be very interested to see how certain players in their respective positions get on. And again, it's hard to pick the Leinster pack to a certain degree. Some of it is set in stone, but the question marks over maybe the back row as well, who plays alongside James Ryan in the second row. And, you know, for Munster, I guess the question is, can they get on top in the pack? Do you believe they have the tools to get on top in the pack?
Yeah, it's going to be a very tight contest, but I think they've been hugely consistent in terms of their set piece all year. Their lineout is one of the most organised in Ireland, in Europe at the moment. I think the scrum has improved, and Dave Kilcoyne is back now as well, so that gives another option. They were struggling at loosehead. I mean, bear in mind, they had to go to Claremont with Josh Witcherly, you know, just out of under-20s rugby, and he played 75 minutes of the game there. Since then, Jeremy Lachman is back. James Cronin is back, and now Dave Kilcoyne is back. So that's going to strengthen their options. But the biggest, I mean, I agree with Bernard in terms of their approach. I don't see Munster changing hugely. They will look for that forward dominance. They will look to play the territorial game. Will look to get a foothold in the Leinster 22, and their maul has been outstanding. And you look at the way the Irish lineout and the Irish maul has gone backwards in the last 12 months, while Munster have gone from strength to strength in that area. So I think O'Connell will be paying a huge amount of emphasis in terms of what Munster are doing there. Are they able to execute against what? You know, when you look at the Leinster side, there's certainly going to be five or six of those starting Leinster forwards are going to be involved in the Irish squad. Pike Furlan, unfortunately, won't be there. So you're looking at your Cian Healy's and your Porter starting, James Ryan. Is an absolute certainty. For me, the interesting one is who they pick in the second row. I wouldn't be surprised to see a Scott Fardy coming back in. For me, I think Ruddock is that talisman with Leinster. So I think, you know, for this type of game, he's tailor-made to start at six. Doris will be eight. And then they could toss a coin with about three or four different fellas to play seven. So the battles, there's very little between them. It's all about generating momentum. It's all about being able to get those forwards on the front foot. And that comes down to the kicking game. And Bernard is right. Munster's kicking game, it wasn't that they kicked a whole lot more than even Leinster going back in August and September. It was that the kicks weren't effective. And I think if Van Gran has learned anything, you go back to the Ulster game in particular. I thought Hugo Keenan gave a masterclass at fullback. Mm. So he is outstanding in that area of the field. So Munster's accuracy from both Murray and JJ, if he starts, has to be absolutely spot on. I don't see a huge variation in the way they're going to play, but I think you're going to see a massive battle up front because Munster will fancy themselves to win that battle. But Leinster, you know, when the chips have been down for them, I can only think, the only game where I saw them comprehensively beaten in the last 18 months was that Saracens quarterfinal when their scrum fell apart, their lineout fell apart. And, you know, when Leinster have to chase a game, they're a different side to the one that sort of goes 6, 9, 12 points ahead and just they just squeeze the life out of teams. So it'll be very interesting from that point of view.
Yeah, just Hugh, if I come in on that, I think, the reason Johan has bit back this week is around Leo's comments post-game, where Leo had a little bit of a dig about the Munster tactics. But the reality is, like, the reason Leo had a dig is that's Leinster's Achilles heel. That's the way to beat them. I'm just looking at some stats here, and Leinster currently ranked top three for 15 of the 21 performance metrics for attack. They're actually 10th. They're actually number one in 10 of them. The way to beat them is how Saracens beat them which is, you know, to play territory. Now, Saracens found an unbelievable advantage at the scrum, which, you know, heightened the how effective that was. But if your set piece is strong and you can actually dominate and win that kicking battle, and as Donal said, you have to get ahead of them. You can't chase Leinster, chase the game against Leinster. But if you flip it over, and Connacht got a lead against them, and Leinster didn't look at all as comfortable. Now Ulster obviously were 9-3 up at half time, but it wasn't far enough for what they didn't follow through on it. But I think that the reason Leo criticised it is because he knows that's the type of game that can put his team into trouble.
Right, that's interesting. So I mean, if Van Graan is, you know, going to read into that, why would he change it, Wes? I'm looking at the Munster pack that started against Connacht the last day, you know, and it wasn't Munster's best performance, but they did a lot of things very, very well. And from 4 to 8, Jean Klein and Ty Bernigan in the second row, Gavin Coombs on the blind side, Peter Manny at 7, and TJ Stander at 8. Is that roughly what you would expect Van Graan to go with, keeping O'Mahony on the open side and the two lads in the second row?
Probably is what I'd expect him to go with. It's probably what I'd go with if it was up to me, but I think the lads are right in terms of, you know, they're not going to deviate too much, but equally, I think there is little wrinkles needed to beat them. I think, you know, Donal mentioned, or someone mentioned a minute ago, you know, you're expecting this kind of fire and brimstone approach, and that's a given, but ultimately, Leinster still have better individuals, you would argue, in most positions, so I don't think just being highly motivated or anything like that is going to do it, so you take that, and you have those solid basics, and then it's what can you add to get the victory. And I think there is evidence lately that both the new coaching additions are not new anymore, I suppose, but both Stephen Larkham and Graham Rowntree's influence is starting to be seen, not in this revolutionary way, but I think there's been a lot of, like, there's been much more variation in strike players and attack by Munster lately, a couple of great tries scored, particularly against Ulster. And I think, like, I've spoken to Graham Rowntree a good few times over the course of the season, and he just seems like a guy who, aside from the technical work, is very positive with players and puts a lot of belief into them. And I think you're seeing that scrum, that front row, they're scrummaging as a real unit, and they're probably outperforming their ability in terms of they're going up against packs with better individuals at times and getting good results out of it. And that's exactly what's needed against Leinster. So, you know, man for man, Leinster are going to be better. So I think it's, can they collectively get at least parity around the set piece, around the breakdown, and then can they bring one or two, like, bespoke little variations to their attack that just see them creep over the line? And that's kind of what you're hoping for, but it's still a massive ask, because I think all Munster's improvement has been against the fact that they were kind of improving with a destination down the line in mind, rather than improving for right now. It's very much building towards something with younger players and an evolving style, rather than being the finished product right now. So as much as there's optimism and we're all excited to talk about the game, you're still playing an excellent team who have better players in 9 or 10 positions of the field than you. So your game plan and your execution is obviously, you're trying to make up a little bit of a talent deficit still.
Just on the JJ Hanrahan thing, Donal, I mean, Bernard's point about JJ over the years is absolutely true. And when the pressure has come on at key moments, he has been found wanting.
That's my opinion. It's an opinion. It's not, we don't know it's true.
No, absolutely it's an opinion. But I think a lot of people would share that opinion. And the fact that Munster haven't really had that strong out-half figure with Joey Kirby's injury since the injury, I think would probably tell its own story. And JJ has obviously been given a lot of different chances across different clubs. And since he kind of broke through as this superstar under 20 international, hasn't really developed into the talent that I guess that a lot of fans might have hoped that he would. Is there not an argument then to start Ben Healy this weekend, Donald, and see how he copes under pressure against Leinster?
There is an argument, of course there is. But, you know, I think you're being a little bit harsh on JJ there. He's had two clubs. He's had Northampton and he's had Munster. I think, in fairness to him, you know, when O'Gara was still there, when he left and went off to Northampton, he went there. I remember meeting Dusty Hare. Remember Dusty Hare was England fullback, played for the Lions in 83. And I remember reading somewhere where he was actually the talent scout for Northampton, and I met him at an Irish under 20 or under 21 match in Donnybrook, just around the time when JJ had been signed for Northampton. And I'd know Dusty well, and geez, I said, what are you doing with Northampton? He explained the whole scouting role, and he was talking about how they had him on their radar since that under 20 or under 21 World Cup campaign where JJ had a really a good tournament. But I said, are you buying him to go over there to be your starting number 10? And he said, yes, absolutely. I think that Stephen Myler was the more experienced fellow there at the time. But if you remember, I think JJ, he got injured at the wrong time. He ended up playing a lot of rugby at 12 over there, and it just didn't work out. JJ's problem, I think, has always been, he always tries almost too hard. He feels as if he has to do something special every time he's playing. That was certainly a problem when he came back to Munster. I remember a Heineken Cup or a Champions Cup game. They were actually beaten by Edinburgh in Murrayfield. He came on as a sub. He put in a little chip, a poorly executed. Edinburgh caught it, counter-attacked, scored, and won the game. It's all those pressure points when he almost feels that he has to prove that he's better than he is. And he's had that pressure on him the whole way through. Now, I thought he had got to the point where he was kind of dealing with that. But, you know, you go back to that particular Leinster game that Birch is talking about. He missed two very kickable kicks at a very important point in the game. So it does play in his mind. There's no question about that. I also, from what I can understand, I think his contract may be up at the end of this season. Mm-hmm. So you look at it from a Munster perspective. Obviously, they're going to have to make a decision. Is Joey Carberry, when is he coming back? Like, certainly the medics at some stage have to say, look, he's ready to play. He's out of the game over a year now. So if JJ comes back, then Munster have a decision in terms of, you know, you have Ben Healy, you have Jack Crowley, and you saw it was in the public domain where Ronan O'Gara went after Crowley to try and attract him to La Rochelle. But Crowley has now backed himself. He said, no, I'm not going. So Munster will have a decision to make there in relation to JJ. So these, you know, that's a huge pressure background for him to be bringing into these games. I think he will start. I also think there is a debate now. You know, when are you going to back Ben Healy? Everything you've asked him to do today, he seems to have performed. Yeah. But there's a big difference when you're going in, starting games and coming off the bench. But look, you're going to have to do it sometime. You're going to have to be thrown in at the deep end. I think this is a hugely pivotal game for JJ. If it goes well, then, you know, you're going into this period after this game where you have sort of Pro 14 matches, which may not mean a huge amount because they could be top of their pool. But with Europe down the line and whatever shape that's going to take, I think this game is absolutely crucial to where JJ Hanrahan is going to end up at the end of the season.
And Birch, the point I was making about this, Dash.
Sorry, yeah. Just wondering, Donal, if you had one of them, if you had a last minute kick from the touchline to win the game, who would you put on it, Healy or Hanrahan?
Good question.
Me?
Today I'd say Healy.
Me too.
I would too. I know that's not the only part of the game, but it does say something about their temperaments.
Yeah, but look, you kept that as a young fella. I saw Healy kicking for, like, Glenstall, as you know. They'd never won a Munster Schools Cup. He was the captain. He was the old half. He was the star player. But he always nailed the kicks. And we have seen that in games. What game was it? He kicked a 55-metre one, I think. He did it Scarlets, if you go back to them. But as a young fella, I've seen this over the years. You know, you're looking at young fellas, and I suppose this is an argument in favour of picking Healy. Young fellas have no inhibitions. They don't see the downsides. It's when you get older and you start thinking about, because you've seen all the things that can go wrong. Whereas young fellas in general don't carry that baggage. So from that perspective, that might answer your question in terms of Healy. But I think if JJ starts, it's a huge game for him.
And just like Bert, you know, my point about JJ, I was a massive, massive fan of his, particularly at underage level. And I was really hoping he was going to turn into this superb player for Munster and indeed for Ireland, but it just hasn't happened. But he has all the tools. It's just up here. Can he get it right on the day in this big match? And if he can, like Munster will fly. If he can't, they're in serious trouble.
Yeah, and like, look, at he went to Claremont, and I'm not sure whether it was 8 from 8 or 9 from 9. So
yeah,
he has had
nine from nine,
and you don't become golden boot unless you're a quality kicker. So I was just, and I said, I hope he starts, and I hope he has, you know, a game that can be the turning point, or it quashes all the doubts about him, because I think he deserves it. I mean, it's not easy. It's a very pressurized position. He is very talented, and you know, like, it'd be great to see him, I suppose, quash those doubts. And if he does play the level he can play at, he could be a key man in a famous win.
Okay, just a couple of words on the backs, Wes, before we move on. I want to talk about something else. The Munster back line, if you just look at it, and even just take Conor Murray and JJ Hanrahan or Healy out of it just for a minute, and from the centre on, you have D'Alende, obviously Chris Farrell, Keith Earls, Andrew Conway, and then possibly Mike Haley. It depends how they're going to shuffle things around. Maybe Shane Daly comes into the mix there, and Haley doesn't start. I don't know how they're going to fix it up. But like, that's a seriously talented Munster back line with a lot of pace. Going up against Leinster backline as well, equally so. It's probably the most exciting Munster backline I think we've seen in quite a while. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think there's plenty of talent from 12 out. I think Mike Haley possibly has been fortunate to. He seems to be the go-to man at 15. Todd Gallagher would probably put him under pressure. He's injured now. I think there's options there with maybe moving Conway to fullback and bringing Darren Sweetenham in, who's been going well. But by and large, they seem to go with Haley for the big games. But I suppose the most interesting thing for me the last few games in that part of the field has been D'Alende's form has really kicked on to the kind of the level we were hoping it would be at. You know, like, it was good from the start, but he's obviously settling more all the time. And I actually asked one of the players about him, just, you know, what did they see from him in training that was different to 12s they've worked with other places. And the answer I got was that he just has gears in him, that he kind of can drift around at 60-70%, but can up it in an instant when the situation demands, and just that he's utterly comfortable and unruffled by any situation he finds himself in. And I think you see that in his play, and I think he's a guy that will almost play to the level of opposition he's against, regardless of who it is. So, like, you know, big players win big games, as the saying goes, and he was signed on big money for games like this. So I'd love to see him go out and really stamp his authority on proceedings and you know, show himself to be what he is, which is the best midfielder that's going to be on view there at the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very excited, Donald, to see what he can do. He does seem to be growing more and more into it. And it's this African swagger / arrogance, whatever way you want to put it, that stands him so well, this absolute self-belief. And you can see it now really taking shape in that midfield.
Yeah, you can. And you go back to, I think, was it the first game, the August game, when Farrell and D'Alende played together for the first time. And I think you had Robbie Henshaw and Gary Ringrose. So, I mean, there was a huge clash there. And you could almost see the body language on the field. Obviously, D'Alende was very much aware of the caliber of player that he was playing against. I'm not sure whether he played against them before at international level, but he has got better and better. And, you know, I think it was that Birch made the point there about being able to step up the levels. He strikes me, if he's playing Dragons in the morning in a Pro 14 game, he'll play at a level that he needs to be effective in that game. If he's playing against Leinster, he'll go up 2 or 3 notches. He's playing for South Africa against New Zealand. He has the capacity to go another gear. And that really is the mark of a quality player. I think Farrell, read an interview from there, was it last week or the week before, when he spoke about how he's now getting more and more comfortable playing with D'Alende, and you know, that body language, the ability to learn and to learn traits and signals. Like Darcy and O'Driscoll had it for years. There were almost this telepathic understanding between them for Leinster and Ireland. And you can see D'Alende and Farrell getting to that point already. So I think it's hugely exciting. Unfortunately, you know, for I think the weather is the one thing that's really pissed him off since he's come over here, and Saturday night could be another unpleasant evening from that perspective. But he's been a massive addition. And so much so, we've forgotten about RG Snyman.
Yeah.
Again, from my conversations with people within the Munster group when they went back to August, September, You know, July, August, September, they were just blown away by what this guy could do. So, you know, he still is that missing ingredient. But D'Allende, I think there was even more pressure on him to perform, given that RJ was probably the more marquee signing in terms of what he could bring up front. But I think D'Allende has delivered on all avenues, and I think you'll see him. He'll be very Saturday night's game and the quality of the opposition that he's playing against.
Yeah. Okay, lads. Well, it's obviously going to be a cracker this weekend. We're waiting for the teams to be announced in a couple of days' time. I just want to talk about a different issue in the game, and specifically around the club game, before we wrap it up for this week. And there was a lot of articles over the weekend. Wes, just to start off, I guess focusing on club rugby, the All-Ireland League, and the state, the financial state of clubs in the Irish Examiner. I know Keane Tracy had a piece in the Irish Independent about Limerick, and I guess the battle between hurling and rugby, that's as he sees it at the moment. But certainly I know from talking to lads around my local area here in Wicklow as well, and Greystones, of which I'm a member, that the club game shows no sign of actually being played at all this season. And I think most people have just given up on the fact that we're going to get fixtures at all given the pandemic. And financially, it's a huge problem for the players as well, obviously trying to keep some way fit and in shape as well. And the RFU having to support a lot of clubs just to keep them from going under in certain cases as well. And it doesn't paint a great picture, I guess, about the health of the club game at the moment.
No, there's not really any answer to it in terms of it is kind of out of people's hands to a degree. I just read before we came on a piece in the Examiner on Saturday, which Donald contributed to. It's very difficult on multiple levels. You kind of think it's going to destroy the fabric of things in some ways, and then in other ways you go, well, look, this thing will end someday, and maybe people will be even more motivated at grassroots level. But I think it unwittingly kind of falls into... I think there's a massive disconnect between professional rugby and let's call it grassroots rugby for the minute. I don't think the IRFU are unhappy about that disconnect. I don't think they see the two as being joined up. Perhaps that's the right approach. Maybe not. But I think this will further grow that divide. And obviously, the most pressing thing is that financially, clubs are just... I mean, it's almost impossible, really, for them to survive at this point, for a lot of them, I'd imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a disconnect there, Donald. And I you know, you've written about this. We've spoken about it on numerous occasions about the club game and why there has to be this disconnect. And why does the RFU not put more emphasis on the top tier of club rugby, set up a 10-team, you know, league and have the connection with the provinces there so that players might be on a semi-professional basis and there is hope that they can actually transfer that into the professional game. It doesn't seem unrealistic to me. Maybe I'm being very naive here, but the RFU don't seem very interested in doing it.
No, well, look, there's no question that there's been a greater divide over the past number of years. And I think, to be fair, David Nusafora, as director of rugby, he made an attempt about 2 years ago to bring sort of the Division 1A clubs closer to the academy setups within the provinces. He was looking at a revamped All-Ireland League where you had 8 teams in Division 1A and 8 in 1B, but I think they went about it the wrong way. They were talking about 2 teams in each province. Now, you turn around to clubs who've been part of an All-Ireland League and have put everything in to retain, say, their status, be it in 1A, 1B or whatever, and all of a sudden, unfortunately, Connacht had no team at the time in 1A. So I think Buccaneers and Galwegians were in Division 2A or B or wherever they were. But all of a sudden, they were going to be elevated up over everyone else. So that was never going to work. I think the concept and the idea of what he was talking about, of having greater alignment between the academies and the Division 1, bear in mind that academy players, contracted players, can only play in Division 1A and 1B. I think the concept was good, but the way they went about it was wrong. And then... of course, clubs immediately got up in arms about what the potential for this thing was, because the next thing that you felt, there was going to be ring fencing for a certain period of time, so therefore there was no promotion and relegation. In my view, every club that wants to have an aspiration of coming from 2C and get it up to 1A, like Highfield here in Cork. They had a bad number of years, went down through the divisions, came back up, were top of 1B, unfortunately looked as if they were going to get into 1A up to the time that the AIL was just, it had to be cancelled. So it is a big worry. I think when those sort of negotiations fell apart in 2018, the RFU almost threw their hat at the club game. But it's a massive concern for me. I mean, look, I'm president of Cork Con this year, so I'm very close to what's happening within the club scene. We're very worried, as are all the clubs, about the fallout from having no rugby for over a year, particularly in that under 20 age bracket. You know, you're now going to have a cohort of players who won't have played in schools rugby for 2 years, or they won't have had a cup campaign, let's say. And they're discovering other sports. They're going to the gym, they're rowing, they're doing other things. And, you know, after a while, they scratch their head and say, Jesus, like, there is life outside of rugby. And that is a major worry. We have players on the other end of the spectrum, maybe 28, 29, who would have played for another few years. But from a conditioning point of view and all that, they can't train, so they've stepped backwards. So there is a huge worry for where the club game is going. I mean, the financial thing is a major issue, but look, we'll survive that. Like, the clubs, you just have to address it and do what you can and move on. I'd be more worried from a playing perspective that we're going to lose a whole cohort of players. And the other, my last sort of, really drives me, like, Leinster, there's a different model in Leinster where they have the school system and, you know, 16 ARB schools or whatever produce massively well organised, massively supported properly by the Leinster branch in terms of development officers and support for their clubs. And the throughput from that source year on year is absolutely huge. And you know, that is the foundation stone for Leinster. It's a different system down here. We need the clubs. We need, and there is a discord. And I think, to be fair to that article in The Independent about Limerick and, you know, where are the players gone? It's something I've been writing about for the last 4 or 5 years, because I see it as a huge worry. Dave Kilcoyne is the only regular Limerick-produced forward that has started for Munster over the past 3 or 4 years. But there is a discord between the schools game and the clubs game down here in Munster, which is massively unhealthy. Young fellas, like, school squads ring fencing almost 45 players, even though they might only use 25, and the other lads can't be, they can't go to the club to play. And this thing just, it's gone on for years, and they can't seem to resolve it, but it's having a detrimental effect on the amount of players playing rugby in Munster, and we need that. You've seen the amount of, the buzz that's around Munster at the moment, I think a lot of that has been generated by the fact that they're regularly now producing 13, 14 homegrown players in their matchday squads. But if they don't resolve this issue between the schools and the clubs down here, it's going to kill the game.
Bert, that's astounding. That Dave Kilcoyne is the only Limerick-based player, a regular feature. You think back to Munster's heyday, O'Connell, Quinn and Leamy, like, it's a frightening indication of where rugby is at.
Quinny and Leamy are Tipperary.
Well, that's Leamy, sorry. Yeah. Well, Quinny played for Shannon, so, but anyways, well, you get my point. But yeah, Bert, I mean, it's quite frightening, isn't it?
Yeah, and I thought, I don't know if you remember, at the end of year briefing with David Nusafora, he was asked about a club game, and he said, oh, he's had his hands full with a professional game, and he hasn't really had a chance to be across where the clubs and schools are at. And I think either his role has changed, because in 2018, he was all over it. You know, he was involved in it. And I think, as head of high performance for Ireland, you have to look at all areas that's involved in the pathway. And whether he likes it or not, the club game is part of the pathway here. You know, even currently, you think of guys like Peter Sullivan from Connacht. You know, he used the AIL to give himself the stepping stone to get a contract. And there's lots of examples of that. And it could be the way it is again, because, you know, the B&I Cup with travel costs, etc., you know, didn't wash its face. And I can't see it ever washing its face, because there's no interest from the public to go watch those games. So I think the club game will continue to be part of the pathway, not for everybody, but part of the pathway for professional rugby players and elite players who come under the high performance bracket. And just because you know, there was conflict and a lack of agreement in 2018, you know, that happened.
Don't throw it all out, like.
Don't forget about it and punish them by ignoring it and letting it die. It's a very stubborn way to look at it. I mean, and you're dealing with something that needs change. I think everyone involved in the club game agrees that it needs to change. But just because there was conflict and lack of agreement, don't let it, as I said, leave it out in the cold. And I think it is important there if you do support the clubs. And I'm involved in Beckett. We're not in the AIL, but we've been in lockdown, out of lockdown, in lockdown. And thankfully, the players have come back under the restrictions that we've been allowed and trained. We haven't got to play any games since the last break. But who knows if they'll keep coming back? And that's worrying from a participation point of view. It's worrying from the health point of view, etc. So it needs some love. It needs some thought. And obviously, Nusafour is very busy at the moment. But he's not. He's not an island in the IRFU. There's lots of people being paid, and their salaries and jobs is to protect and nurture the game. So it'd be great to see some kind of dialogue or initiative from the IRFU to help the club game when we come out of this, or at least talk about what we might do to come out of it.
I was talking to a friend of mine about this last night, and he mentioned the Scottish Sixes program, Birch, that's in operation at the moment. So it's six teams. They're semi-professional. I think they're all on something like 12 and a half grand a year, which isn't a lot, but it covers expenses, and at least it's something. And it's trying to, bridge that divide between the two professional squads, the Scottish international team and the club game in Scotland, which used to be very strong but has been allowed to fade away. And I thought, why could we not do something similar like that here?
Look, I think that's what the Scots have decided is best for their model. I actually don't really think we need to contract club players. I think what they just need is a really good competition structure with players who are already contracted dipping in and out, when they're available. So under 20s, for example, and we've seen them play in the AIL. Donal's worked on RT for under 20s with me, and he's known a lot about some of the players who've now broken into the Munster setup because he's seen them play for Cork Conn in the AIL. So I don't think we need to add a huge amount more in terms of resources, in terms of financially contracting club players. I just think it's actually using the 120 players that we have contracted. Maybe there's actually more because, 150 players we have contracted, and try in some way reignite the close links that were there from the club to the professional game, which I see getting further away. And I don't think that's healthy. So, the Scots have picked that solution for them because, they have a smaller playing pool, etc. I don't think we need to look at more investment. I just think we need to have more dialogue and more connections.
I agree totally with that. I think if you go down a semi-professional rank in club rugby, you're absolutely gone out the door because you lose all the values that are associated with a club. You're going to have fellas who are mixing and moving all the time to come into those clubs who have those semi-professional contracts. I think it's more important. I'd be much happier to work in alignment, say, with the Munster Academy down here, provide a platform for those academy players to play at a decent level. Give them an understanding as to what representing a club with a long history and tradition is all about. Because, I've always been of the view, academies produce individuals. But at the end of the day, it's a team sport. And you've got to buy in to your team ethics and who you represent and all of that. And I think club rugby provides that. And the last point on it is, I think if you go down that semi-professional track, but these people are coming into your club, they're being driven and guided by, let's say, Munster or the Munster Academy. So all of a sudden, you're handing ownership of your club over to the Munster Academy because they're telling you, we want A, B, C, D, and E to be picked in this game next week. And that's a dangerous path because people then, you lose control of your own club. And people will walk away from the club because all you do is you become a conduit of the professional game. So therefore, I wouldn't be in favour of that semi-professional thing at all. I think, as Birch alluded to, Scotland have that model for a particular reasons. Bear in mind, they've only two professional outlets. So therefore, this is their way of compensating for that. I think a vibrant All-Ireland League And you know, I've seen many fantastic games at 1A and 1B level over the past number of years where you have that quality, where you have, and there's been numerous players who've got their opportunities to the clubs. I've come across even players, development contract players, who've come back into AIL and they say, Jesus, the quality of that was way better than we thought. So look, it's not rocket science. There is a way of fixing it. If David Nusafora, to be fair, I think the professional game, there's so many issues challenging the professional game at the moment that I could understand why amateur club rugby isn't on his priority list. But it isn't as if there isn't enough people within the IRFU who aren't long enough in the game or smart enough to recognise the role that the clubs have. To be fair, Colin McEntee now has come in heading up that area. He is a player who would have come through Lansdowne over the years. He played in the old Ireland A or Ireland B or Ireland A at the time. So he, to be fair to him, he does have, he has a very good feel for the club system in Ireland. I don't think it takes rocket science to figure it out, but I wouldn't be in favour at all of going down that sort of semi-professional route.
And something, Wes, just a last word to you, it just needs to happen. Somebody needs to take the bull by the horns here. Like, it would be tragic if the club game were to let die off because nobody within the RFU managed to grab the bull by the horns here. And, you know, fix the problem. It is very fixable. We're not asking for miracles to be happening here. It's fixable.
Yeah, but what are you asking for? And this is part of the problem, is that even bringing up the conversation here, it's so unwieldy and goes in so many different directions that it becomes very abstract. And I think if you don't have this, like, emotional attachment to the subjects, like some of the people making the decisions don't, it's too unwieldy to actually delve into. There's not a lot of motivation for it. But I give you 2 points on the Limerick player production thing, which tie into the wider discussion. There was this article about, you know, GAA and the strides they've made and how rugby will lose players to it. One, I don't agree with it right now. It might have an impact in the future, but Limerick winning 2 All-Irelands in the last 3 years hasn't affected the composition of the Munster senior squad right now because it just doesn't work that way. But one thing the GAA doesn't have in Limerick is it doesn't have any club in a regeneration area in Limerick City. There's a rugby club in each one. Thomond is in Moyross. Young Munsters is there in Ballincor Weston, South Hill area. St Mary's is in the Island Fields. They're all catered for, which is very unusual in an Irish context that there's a rugby club in each one of those areas and not a GAA one. So Keith Earls is from Moyross. He came through, burst onto the scene in 2008, more or less. There's a huge population there. There's a rugby club there. There's no GAA club there. What have Munster or the IRFU done to build on Keith Earls' profile in that area and bring through more players? Conor Murray, from the total opposite end of the spectrum, is from Patrick's Well, which is a diehard hurling stronghold, the equivalent of anywhere in the country. Conor Murray and Owen Redden were the first two nines playing for Ireland in the same 23 for a couple of seasons. And both of them grew up a mile apart from each other in Patrick's Well, which had never had a rugby player come from there before. Yet, there's no link in the greater consciousness in Limerick or in a wider set that Conor Murray is actually from Patrick's Well. He's not identified with that the way Cian Lynch, Aaron Gillan, Dermot Burns are. Why is that? Why have no inroads been made there? So I suppose that speaks to the wider point on the IRFU level that since the game's gone professional, the IRFU's concern is with running a business and running an elite professional sport. So I think someone like David Nusafora, his job is to look at the production of players for Ireland. So if those players are being produced in sufficient numbers, which they are through other avenues like the school system in Leinster that Donald referenced, then he doesn't need to concern himself with these other things. But that's not to say that you can't improve your output by concentrating on these very obvious wins for you. Like, why has no program in 20 years been initiated to engage with immigrant communities in Ireland? It serves a social purpose, and also bottom line, it creates more players. And by the way, it creates players that may bring a different physical skill set to things than a typical Irish kid.
Yeah.
Why has no engagement been made with that community? So
no idea.
There's a massive lack of imagination all across the board on this. And like, I could write a thesis on that Limerick issue for you. No problem. I've been talking about it for 5 years. But you can't engage it properly in 2 minutes.
Like, it's David Mr. Ford
that need to be engaged
in a
systemic way.
To be fair, Wes, you've got to bring a bit of passion into your argument.
Come here. If David Nusafour is listening to this, Wes Liddy is open to offers to take over the rejuvenation of the club game across Ireland, and I'll second him for that. But there's a lot of good points there, Donald. And look, it is a passionate topic among people who grew up playing club rugby, who have an association and attraction with club rugby. And we're almost out of time. We're not going to solve the problems tonight, but it's something that if nothing is done in the next couple of years, even just post pandemic, the club game could potentially just die off altogether, and that would be horrific.
Yeah, it is. And look, I take the point. David Nusafora's job is to make sure that there is a production line of players for the Irish team, and by and large, that's happening. But it has longer concerns for Munster. Again, we're in a kind of a nice pretty period at the moment, because there is a lot of guys who've come through the system down here. But, you know, it tends to come in waves. And Wes is absolutely right. Limerick winning the All-Ireland in the last 2 years, that had nothing to do with the fact that there's only one Limerick forward on the team for the past 4 or 5. Look, it's an emotive argument. I would be hugely passionate about it as well, because, look, I've had a long association with Limerick clubs over a long time. In the old battlegrounds of Munster Senior Cups and All-Ireland Leagues. It's not an issue that we're going to be able to resolve here, but it is something that certainly within Munster, if the RFU aren't going to take the lead, then people within Munster have to try and take the lead, because, you know, it's not something. We can't afford to have a Munster. It is like an Irish team is always stronger when Munster are good, when Ulster are good. Likewise, Munster will never be at the peak of their powers unless Limerick rugby is producing the quality of players that we saw and took for granted for when they were winning Heineken Cups in the noughties.
Can I give you one last one briefly, Donal, just on that point? We've seen 15 of this Limerick Hurling squad came out of Ardscoil Rheis. There's been a huge move towards hurling in the school. Now, Ardscoil Rheis have produced Paul O'Connell, Dave Kilcoyne, Sean Cronin, Mossy Lawler. They never won a senior cup, but they've produced a lot of high-quality players. I won't say they've been lost as a rugby production line, but they've been diminished. Just by the by, the principal of Crescent Camp in Limerick now, which has produced David Wallace, Peter Clossy, Paul Wallace, Owen Redden, Calvin Nash, I could go on, is Dermot Mullins, who is the manager of the Limerick Minor Hurling team, who just won 2 Munster titles in a row. Gary Kirby, a 5-time All-Star from Limerick, is in coaching in the school. They won a Munster Colleges tournament this year. The same as Christians did in hurling, by the way. Like, if you lose Crescent now on top of Ardscoil from the production line, I mean, you might as well throw your hat at it if you've taken 2 of your 5 schools out of the equation.
Yeah.
And no one's addressing it on a bespoke individual level.
No, you're right. Right, lads, you know, we'll wrap it up for this week. This is going to rear its head again, and hopefully we'll have something more positive to say about it. Enjoy the match this weekend, lads. We'll be back next week to review the probables Leinster against the possibles Munster on the podcast. Enjoy the match, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, you better check your post in the next week.
Good luck.